Let's begin. Thank you for coming. There's a tradition of learning. Many people learn all night. I don't think we'll be doing that as a group on Hoshana Rabbah, but even if we're not going to, as a group, learn all night, it's still nice to learn a little bit on Hoshana Rabbah. There's a tradition that the judgment that started in Rosh Hashanah and continued on Yom Kippur, the last eeks away, and finally there's a little bit left even until Hoshana Rabbah. We know tomorrow morning the davening takes even a certain somber Yom Nerayim element. So there's a tradition of extra learning on Hoshana Rabbah, and you have nothing to lose. Learning is always good. So whatever the, if Hoshana Rabbah is the excuse, so to speak, for an extra shiur, so then why not? I wanted to speak about a topic which I've thought about a lot recently, and I think is really, really important. I don't usually say that about my own lectures, but I don't mean my lecture, I mean the topic. It's a really, really important topic, because I have found over the years, as I've gotten older and I see challenges for myself and for people in the various communities in which I've lived, both in the States and in Israel, I even see challenges for my children when it comes at various points to davening. So I think that the more we think about it, if we're honest, for a lot of people, even people who are observant and committed, but it seems that davening is something that's really hard for a lot of people. It's a huge, huge issue and could not possibly be analyzed, let alone solved, quote-unquote, in any one lecture. So I can't pretend to imagine doing that. But I have tried to give some thought recently, and I have given, over the last few months, recently some lectures and devoted myself considerably to thinking about what the problems are, what the challenges are, and what might be possible approaches or solutions to try to help people who would like to daven better. I'm not discussing trying to convince people that it's important to daven or daven better. That's a separate topic. But I'm talking about people who would like to come, who do come to shul, would like to come more often than they do. Or they do come to shul and they'd like to have more meaningful experience than they do. So again, all sorts of circumstances about the shul and the davening, and those are things that can change from shul to shul, and again, I can't address those. But I think if we're really, really honest, the source of the problem, if you'll call it that, really is on the inside. And therefore the solution, if we can find one or even begin to attempt to locate one, is going to happen on the inside. All the things which we look to blame, you'll forgive me, are probably more excuses, whether it's the rabbi, the sermon, the shul, the speed, the gabbai, the air conditioning, all these kind of things that, you know, shul starts too late, it starts too early, it goes too fast, it goes too slow. There's a little truth to all of them, but they all add up to one big lie. Because the real truth is not about any of that. The real truth is that it's about us. And therefore, as the old proverb goes, you know, there was a person who was trying to cut wood, and he had this tremendous deadline, and they said to him, you know, you should take some time off and, you know, sharpen the saw. He said, I don't have time. But of course, we realize it's foolish, because if he would take the time out to sharpen the saw, then he would cut a lot more than if he keeps on cutting with a dull saw. So similarly, there are all sorts of solutions. There's books about davening, which are important. You could read, and you can understand the words better. And there's storybooks about davening. There are philosophical books about davening. There's mystical books about davening. They're all good, but they're all Band-Aids. Because we have to sharpen the saw, and we are the saw. We have to figure out a way to make ourselves more in tune with what davening is supposed to be. And if that's the case, then that will take care of most, if not all, of the challenges. I want to kind of introduce this with a story. I find it to be a very moving and insightful, I'd say even profound story. And it's a story, given the audience, you might say it's a surprising source, but whatever our differences are perhaps in other areas, certainly can learn many things from the Satmar Rebbe. Don't have to take his approach to other things or to Zionism. That's not important. But he was a big, big tzaddik and a big, big, big Talmid Chacham. And the story goes as follows. You know, in many Hasidicas, I guess, including in Satmar, there's a tradition that at the end of the wedding, they have a badchan, which is often someone who's professional, who's paid to get acquainted with the chassan and kala and the families. They make some kind of a poem or a rhyme, which they entertain the guests with at the end of the wedding. So apparently, the Satmar Rebbe had a very distinctive way of davening. I don't really know what that was, but he had a very distinctive way of davening. And he was going to be at a certain wedding, and the Badchan apparently did a great imitation. But it's the Rebbe. So he went over to the Rebbe in advance of the wedding. He said, you know, it was going to be this wedding, would it be okay with the Rebbe if I would imitate him is what he davens at the wedding. And the Rebbe gave him his full blessing. It's no problem, it's good taste, it's meant to celebrate the wedding, chasan and kala, no problem. So the wedding ends, the wedding comes, and they call up the badchan, and he gives this big rousing performance, everyone's laughing, and one of the highlights of the whole performance is his unbelievable spot-on imitation of the way the Rebbe davens. Problem is, at some point during the performance, the Badcha notices, that the Rebbe's crying. So afterwards, he runs over to him, and he begs profusely, apologizing, I'm so sorry, maybe I misunderstood, I thought the Rebbe had said it would be okay, and he's profusely apologetic, and he says, you know, I'm really so sorry. So at which point the Rebbe explains, you don't have to apologize. You didn't do anything wrong. He said, well, if I didn't do anything wrong, then why is the Rebbe crying? He said, well, when I realized how perfectly you were imitating me, when I saw that, I realized how often I'm just imitating myself. And that really gave me pause. So I think that if we think about it, the same thing is true for us. We kind of go through the motions, we get familiar with something, we get into a habit, and it really is a problem. Now, part of the issue, and this is what I want to address, again, I can't address everything in one lecture, but part of the issue would seem to be that our enemy is the sitter. And that is the notion or the phenomenon, the reality of the fixed text. If you ask most people, they would say to you, you know, if I could speak in my own language, whether it's literally my vernacular, a language I understand better, or instead of using the ancient rabbi's words from thousands of years ago, I could pick my own language, I could speak to the situation that I'm in, my own emotions, my own circumstances. So that would be so much better. And yet I'm stuck with a fixed text which somebody else wrote 1,000, 2,000 years ago. Plus, I say the same thing every day, 3 times a day, how are you supposed to have kavanah for something that's so repetitive? Aren't we, in essence, really just imitating ourselves? And the truth is, it's a real question. It's not a cynic's question. It's a real question. If one takes a look at the, if you want, there's some source sheets on the front of the page, in the front of the chairs here, if you'd like to come up. If you take a look at the first source, this is Rashi. It's 2 pages. This is Rashi in the Kriya Shema, Anochi Mitzavcha Hayom. So Hashem tells us about this great declaration of monotheism, of Kriya Shema, of dedication to Hashem, which I've commanded you Hayom today. What's the stress on Hayom? So Rashi says in the first source that you shouldn't look at the Torah, you shouldn't look at the words of Shema, just like some rule that was legislated that's old and therefore has no excitement. Ela kechadasha. And Rashi makes the incredibly insightful point, Shakol Ratzin Lekrasa. That if something is new, then everyone wants to do it. If something is new, everyone runs to do something. Everyone's excited. But if something's not new, if we're just repeating it all the time, so you can understand why we would get a little bit bored. Now, being bored or feeling repetitive, not having excitement or kavana, this would seem to be a problem for any kind of a mitzvah, for any mitzvah. You know, you shake lulav or you sit in the sukkah and you don't feel so excited about it, you don't feel passion. So that would be true and a problem for anything. But it would seem to be a particularly almost fatal flaw and almost a paralyzing problem for davening. After all, davening of all things, Chazal very famously defined for us in source number 2, the Gemara, where the Pasuk says, again, also from the Shema, Ula'avas Hashem Elokechem, Ula'avdo B'cholavavchem. So the Gemara, so a Medrash, what does that mean to serve? La'avdo sounds like you're working. Well, you don't work with your heart. Working is usually something that's more physical. What do we think of La'avdo with your heart? What does that mean? And the Gemara says, Avodah Shebelev Heviomer Zut Fila. In other words, davening more than any other ritual, more than any other mitzvah, requires engagement of the heart, requires kavanah, requires one's person to be suffused and connected to it. If you shake the lulav but you don't have kavana, at least you shook the lulav. But mouthing words where you don't have any intent, you don't mean them, would seem to be far more pointless. I mean, just imagine in any relationship, imagine you are, professing your undying love to your spouse, and meanwhile, as your spouse is looking at you, he or she sees you're staring off into space. Nowadays, you're checking your email. You seem to be reciting a formula that someone else, you read it off of a Hallmark card. I mean, it's one thing if for example, as a man, you buy your wife nice jewelry, but she doesn't feel you put all your heart into it. Okay, well, at least you got a good gift. But when the gift is supposed to be the words that you're saying, when the whole point of the exercise is to express your feelings, and there you don't even have any intention, your mind is somewhere else, your heart is... So then really, it seems to be pointless. Now, before we try to address something very specific and try to suggest perhaps what might be shifts in our perspective, which could help us understand things and improve, it's worth reviewing a text which is two texts really, which trace the history of where did the Siddur come from? Because that's really what our topic is. The Siddur, and for now we're obviously focusing on its challenges, hopefully we'll shortly transition to its opportunities and the beauty of the Siddur and the opportunities that it presents. But
if you don't understand the Hebrew. Like, if I'm professing my nine love to my husband, right, I understand the words I'm saying.
Correct.
But even
so,
if I don't understand the words,
No, it's not. That's true. Understanding the words, that is so, your point is well taken. I would say that is so basic that I'm not really even planning on addressing that. In other words, it's a given that that a person should understand the basic words that they're saying. There's no question about it. According to the Rambam, for example, just aside from what you're saying, which is common sense, but beyond that, even from a strict halachic perspective, the Rambam makes it clear that at least minimally, the original brachos, the first three brachos of Shemona Esrei, person must understand the words, and optimally really should understand the words of everything. The whole issue of the davening even before the Shemona Esrei, after the Shemona Esrei, this is not a course in tefillah. We only have less than an hour together. I can't address everything. But there's no question, you're right. Elementary to this is that there has to be some basic understanding. It's a halacha, and anyone who's asked me, I've advised them, not only should you minimally, if you don't understand the words, have a siddur which has a translation into the vernacular English, if that's what you understand, but if one has a choice and one feels it's necessary, you can daven in English. Not just that you can daven in Hebrew and look at the English. So you're 100% right. But let's go back to understand, where does the siddur come from? Why do we have to have a siddur? What were Chazal trying, what's the history of it? What were they trying to accomplish? I think if we review that history, we'll even get a sense that they were sensitive to the issue. So first of all, the text, we have one or two texts in the Gemara that address this. One classic one is in source number 3, the Gemara Megillah tells us when is the time period, what was this, when did it happen? Anyone know? The original Siddur, the first basic of the Siddur started in the beginning of Bayis Sheni. It started off in the beginning of the Bayis Sheni, and then eventually around 400 years later, which is 400 years after the Churban, I should say, it was finally crystallized and formalized into the text that we have. But the Gemara starts off by telling us, this is working backwards, this is the 400 years later, that there was someone named Shimon HaPakuli. Pakuli is a very awkward word. It basically means he was a cotton merchant. Anyone in the cotton business? Commodities trader? So Shimon HaPakuli was in the cotton business, but he was a big tzaddik and a big Talmid Chacham, and it says he was Hisdir, Yudches Brachos Lefnei Rabban Gamliel Al HaSeder B'Yavne, right? We know, Tein Li Yavne B'Chachameh, this is after the Churban. So the Gemara understands right away that they didn't wait until after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash to have a Siddur. It came even before that. So the Gemara explains that in fact what happened much earlier, as I say, in the beginning of the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, Kuf Chav Zekenim, 120 of the biggest tzaddikim, the elders, Ubahem Kama Nevi'im, there were still Nevi'im, prophets who were involved, Tiknu Yudches Brachos Al HaSeder. The basic Shemona Esrei, which is again, when Chazal speak about davening, they mean the Shemona Esrei, that's the essence of davening. It was originally written by the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, perhaps one of the most important and transformative bodies of all of Jewish history. And Gemara makes it clear, we should realize, it was written with prophetic inspiration. There were even prophets, Nevi'im, are part of this. So the Gemara says, well, what did you need the cotton trader of Shimon HaPkuli later on? So the Gemara explains actually something really shocking, if not frightening. The Gemara says, what happened? Shikichum v'chazer v'sidrum. Now some say it means literally people forgot how to daven and he had to reorganize it, or others think that that's just too radical, that's just impossible to believe, but rather that the order, which is also deliberate, maybe the order got somehow, not that they forgot all the brachos, but they forgot the order, and then he reorganized the order. But one way or the other, there was some lapse or some downturn, some dip, and then things kind of got crystallized and formalized to the point which we're all familiar with nowadays, already sometime after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. So if that's the case, now that's a long time ago, right? The second Beis HaMikdash is a long time ago. Anshei Knesset HaGdola seems like a long time ago. However, there's one important thing. Judaism didn't start in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. Right? That means that there was some period of Jewish history before they even had an initial attempt at making the Siddur and formalizing the Shemone Esrei. So what did they do before then? So this is actually the subject of a great, great machlokas. There is an opinion of the Ramban who said, you're right, you know why? Because strictly speaking, there was no obligation to daven before that. Yes, you seem
to
be very
bothered. I have a lot of questions on davening, so.
Okay, well, let's try to, okay,
no,
and
but
take one now.
Karbonos, just answer your question, weren't the karbonos in place of, like, don't we only do daven now
There's a machlokes about that. It's a Gemara in Brachos, whether Tfilos Keneged Avos or Keneged Karbonos Tiknum. That's a machlokes. But even if you assume that they are a response to our inability to make Karbonos, the question is, does that mean they didn't daven in the time of the Beis HaMikdash?
Oh, they did.
Well, that's the question. Give me time. So the Ramban says no. Ramban says they were allowed to daven. People may have davened personalized or spontaneous tefillos, but there was no, strictly speaking, obligation to daven. What do we have instead? We had the sacrificial service. We had the karbanos. That's the Ramban's. Now, just as an aside, the Ramban does say that the Torah obligates davening when it comes to a moment of tzara, be'es tzara, crisis. Very striking. You know, we've all heard of the phrase, I think, right? No atheist in a foxhole. So that's not just a pithy saying. The Ramban paskins it. The Ramban says that if a person is in a foxhole, proverbially, if one is in a moment of crisis, there's an obligation to daven. And Rav Moshe Feinstein explains the reason is because to daven in a moment of crisis is not a quote-unquote mitzvah of davening. It's a mitzvah, it's an act of faith. And therefore, conversely, to not daven in a moment of crisis is on some level a kind of heresy or denying of Hashem. That's why Rav Moshe Feinstein, just as an aside, Rav Moshe Feinstein assumed that at least in crisis, non-Jews are obligated to daven as well. Because non-Jews have an obligation to believe in Hashem. And if you assume that davening in crisis is an expression of belief, then that would be something that would be equally obligatory on non-Jews. Very interesting. But that's the Ramban's view. But perhaps more well-known is the view of the Rambam. The Rambam takes a more nuanced view. In other words, according to the Ramban, from the Torah, there's no obligation of daily davening whatsoever, and went from 0 to 100. One day, Chazal woke up in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, and they said, for whatever the reason is, now we have the new thing called daily prayer. The Ramban's view, the Rambam, that's Ramban, Nachmanides. The Rambam, Maimonides, his view is a little bit more nuanced. And I'm not going to read it all inside, but these are very, very important and very, very relevant paragraph here written in the Rambam in his opening four halachos here, very famous, of Hilchos Tefillah. And the Rambam begins by making something very clear unequivocally. Mitzvot aseh lehispalel b'chol yom. The Rambam disagrees. He says, no, even in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, even with the karbonos, there was still a mitzvah to daven every single day. What's that based on? The pasuk we saw before. If you have Avadatem et Hashem, Elokeichem. There's a mitzvah to serve Hashem. Avodah Shebelev, that's a mitzvah. The Rambam understands that is a bona fide drasha that created an obligation on Jews to daven every single day. However, says the Rambam, despite that fact, Chazal still needed to come in, or there was still what Chazal, for Chazal to change in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. And what was that? So the Rambam continues and tells us very importantly. There were three things which have become part and parcel of our everyday davening experience, which the Chazal had added on, which were not from the Torah. Number one, says the Rambam, minyan hatfilos. How many times a day to daven? So we, one second please. We daven three times a day. That is not from the Torah, says the Rambam. That came from the rabbis. That's from Chazal. Number two, the Mishnah hatfilah. That means the nusach, the sitter. The Rambam says strikingly that the text was totally, could be personalized. There was no formal Shmon Esrei or formal text. Now, I'm not going to read it inside, but later on the Rambam says that even in your personalized, spontaneous tefillah, there was a format that everyone had to follow, even if you put all your own words. And that was the format which we have in the Shemon Esrei of Shevach. We begin by praising God, then Bakasha, then we ask Him for whatever we want, and then finally Hodah, we thank Him. Says the Rambam, even in your own words, you start off with saying, God, you're great, please help me with my business deal tomorrow, thank you very much. That's in one sentence, you had this three-part structure. You praised Him, you asked Him, you thanked Him. But other than that, you could have said it in whatever words you wanted. So how many times a day? Up to you. What words you used? Up to you. And finally, the Rambam says, number three, the Zman Kavua. When? The idea that you have to daven in the morning, afternoon, and night. That also is not from the Torah. So at any time in the day, as many times as you wanted, and whatever words you wanted, providing you followed the format, the Rambam says, you had license to do whatever you want. You had to daven once a day, but it could be whatever words, whatever time, and as many times as you wanted in the day. What happened? I'll take your question in a second. Let me just get the wrong. So if that's the case, according to the Rambam, there was a Torah obligation of davening, so then what did the Chazal have to come in and, you know, fix things? What were they trying to fix? What was the problem? Why? You know, they're not, you know, busybodies. They didn't come in for no reason. So the Rambam, again, I won't read it inside here, but if you look in Halacha Dal, that's the last big section, your 10 lines or so, the Rambam tells us there's a problem, which we are familiar with in the 20th century or earlier, which in our own diaspora, which is, says the Rambam, when the Jews got exiled out of Israel, when the Jews were into the diaspora, what happened? What gets lost? We know this happened in the modern time. Lashon HaKodesh, Ivrit. People lost the mother tongue. And not only that, they got all mixed up. It wasn't, you know, nowadays, it was, you know, the nation states didn't really exist. You had tribes and people mixed up everywhere. Says the Rambam, people, you know, we have a phenomenon, unfortunately, today's age, you know, some people, you have heard of the new dialect called Yinglish, right? Certain people, you know, again, sometimes like kind of for charm, you know, people throw in a Yiddish word. I personally think that's fine. But there are certain people, and I have to say, I've met them, they literally cannot get out a sentence in one language. It will be some mix of English, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Yiddish. I've sometimes had all four in one sentence. And I remember once, I have to say, it wasn't from any yeshiva that I went to, but I remember once I was at a Sheva Brachos on a Shabbos afternoon, and one of the Chassan's friends was speaking, or it was an offer of something like that. It was an offer of actually. And he was trying, because the crowd would have been fine with an English speech. He could not get through a sentence just in English. Couldn't. He's American, his whole life in America, but he couldn't. The English, right? So we, again, I think, there's something bad about that, right? So that's what the Rambam says was happening there. They were all confused, Bavel and Paras and this and that. They couldn't get through anything, and therefore they had trouble davening. They couldn't express themselves. And therefore, once they couldn't really get a thought, so they stopped doing it. And the whole system, the Rambam says, was falling apart. They were not saying praise, they weren't doing anything to Hashem. And then he says, Kaven Shara Ezra Bezdino Kach Omdu Vitiknu Lam Shimon Esrei Brachos Al Seder. So the Chachamim at that time realized in the beginning of Asher Tzedola that they needed to do something. They needed to create a standard text, which even if that wasn't the language that people were fluent in speaking, but just like as Americans, many Americans unfortunately don't know Hebrew, but if they're raised in a Jewish home in a day school, they learn Hebrew, at least they know the sitter. So too, they said, even if they're speaking whatever dialects of Persian and Babylonian and who knows what they're speaking in Greek and Syrian Greek and whatever else they're speaking, it doesn't matter, because at least this, now they'll know how to talk to Hashem because they'll have a set text. When they're trying to figure it out on their own, they can't do it, they weren't fluent enough. But when they had a set text, so that they'll repeat over and over again, that they will learn. That's what the Rambam says. Fascinating. Now why do I stress this to you? Because even according to the Rambam, who is the arch representative and advocate of a Torah concept of davening on a daily basis. But what do you see from the Rambam? That even he implicitly is acknowledging that the sitter is not ideal. The sitter was a necessary solution to a vexing problem. It became vitally important. But even the Rambam, you know, here it wasn't Chazal coming up with something new, kind of to create something we never had before, a Purim or a Hanukkah. Chazal were solving a problem, but it would seem reasonable to deduce that would we have never had the problem, would that even be better? We imagine that Torah had the ideal vision, because we weren't living up to it, so Chazal had to come in and put like a, you know, a safety net. But even the Rambam's original vision, his sketch, and his scheme of the Torah obligation, even though there was a little structure, it had to be daily, but I would say 90 to 95% of that experience would have been subjective and personalized. I mean, I think you could safely say no two people in any one room would be saying the same thing at the same time of day, because you could pick any time of day with any words you wanted. And that, for the Rambam, was ideal. So again, we have a little bit of a historical explanation of why that changed. But again, I just want to stress, again, we're going to spend the rest of this year now kind of talking about why the sitter is so great and all the benefits of it. We're going to get to that in a second, and there's some very important things I have to share with you. But at the outset, I think it's just important to underscore that sometimes, whether it's ourselves, our children, our students, if they, again, if some of this is done respectfully, but if they express this kind of frustration and this wistful, almost, you know, longing, if they could just, you know, it's never a good idea to dismiss anybody. It's not nice. But even beyond the not nice, there's a certain genuine substance to that critique. Because even according to the Rambam, it really isn't the original vision. The original vision was something that was more subjective and what was more, again, it's not spontaneous, but at least was more personalized. And therefore, the fact that someone might feel that chisaron, as we would say, that deficiency, I think is completely legitimate. It just underscores the importance of the rest of the shir, which is, well, given the reality that we have, can we not appreciate some of the what I think are really, truly, absolutely crucial and vital benefits that the sitter provides, despite the fact that there does seem to be obstacle that it itself creates. Yes, I'm sorry. You're very patient.
It's very difficult for me to explain myself
in English. Okay. Okay. Yes. Yes. Exactly. So again, the question. Right. So, well, again, this is the way the Rambam scheme is. Again, you didn't have a set time, at least not originally, but midrabanan we do. Right, the Gemara Bracho says, from Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, or based on the Karbanos, that's the debate there, we have the morning, the evening, the afternoon, we have that now. Again, this, I'm not questioning status quo. We have a sitter, we have a Shachar Mechamar, if I'd be the last person, I'm not a revolutionary at all. But the question is to try to understand how we can help improve our davening by appreciating the opportunities, the benefits that this sitter presents to us. So I want to share with you, I want to take this opportunity even to just throw out there that I have a friend, Rabbi Yitzi Blau, who gave a shiur on this topic a number of years ago, and I definitely benefited, hopefully contributed a lot of my own stuff, but definitely contributed some of my, some of the initial ideas and sources that I heard from Rabbi Blau. But I want to share with you, time permitting, 3, 4, maybe we'll have time, 5 different things which I think we should realize are both benefits and opportunities which really are presented by using the sitter as the basis. So the first point I want to mention is as follows. As much as we think about, and I dare say sometimes we even romanticize, the notion of the spontaneous, individualized, personalized tefillah, the reality is that human nature being what it is, we're creatures of habit. And we need the sitter far more than we realize. And I said two things, and I want to, even though they're very similar and they're related, but let me be very clear, because you could say there really are two slightly different things. Number one is, we often think that if I didn't have this crushing regular schedule of davening and the sitter, you know, that my life would be so much more free-flowing and spontaneous, and the reality is, for 99% of people, it's not true at all. If we didn't have the structure that religion gives our day and our life, then we would have some other structure. Because human beings crave and need, for a variety of reasons, a certain structure and habit. So the thought which we often have, especially when we're younger, that there's the structure and the habit of davening or religion, and then there would be this all this freedom on the other side, it's really, for most part, a false choice, because it's not true. But more specifically, something that I myself have even seen is that if you take the sitter away from people and say, okay, great, you could daven however you want, most people don't get that far at all. We simply need that help. And if you take a look at source number 5, the Gemara in Brachos, I think if we appreciate what what happened in between the lines, you'll see that this phenomenon really did play out. The Gemara in Brachos, which I'm giving you a small selection of, and I'm not even going to read most of it inside, this is the Gemara which tells us the following. Now again, I want you to try to put yourself, pretend you are from the Chachamim of the second Beis HaMikdash time. You are from the Anshei Knesset Gedola. You are that generation. And you've been living, I don't know, the first 60 or 70 years of your life pre-Asiddur, pre-Shimon Esrei, and therefore you davened daily, let's say according to the Rambam, in whatever words you wanted. And then came along the Chachamim, and they made this thing called the Siddur at the time, 18, then eventually 19 brachos. We took away all your fun, so to speak. We took away all your individuality, all your personalizing ability. And we said, you have to say these words. So, what's left? You feel a certain suffocation. You feel something got taken away from you. So, sure enough, the Gemara on Daf Yud Zayin gives us a number of examples. I only gave you brief selections from a few of them. That where the Gemara says after about a number of different chachamim, Basar Tzelusei Amar Hachi, that after they finish the davening, now the chachamim have laid down the law, you have to say these 18, 19 brachos, then they added their own personal brachos after that. In other words, if the Chazal have said we now have to formalize things for the first 18, 19 brachos, okay, but I can after that add things. There's nothing wrong with that, right? And you could understand, again, especially historically and psychologically, you could easily understand the need, especially in those early generations where they had been so used to having their own davening. So sure enough, the Gemara lists a number of the davening, the tefillos, the chachamim personally, for themselves. They weren't advocating it necessarily. They weren't requiring it, certainly. But they add certain tefillos that people said on their own. Some of them we haven't really heard of. Some of them are quite famous. For example, just on the Yom and the Roim davening, the Elokai Achlo Notzarti, Eini Kadayev, Achrish Notzarti, that was from that the way it evolved in the Minog, I don't know exactly what point in history this happened, it became part of the Yom and the Roim Machzer. But in the Gemara Brachos, it doesn't have anything about Yom and the Roim. The Gemara says that there was a particular one of the Chachamim, he said this after his davening, on a daily basis perhaps. And then, of course, the most famous one, the one that one way or another became part of our Siddur, which is what I gave you here in the text in number 5, is the one that we are all familiar with, the Elokai Netzor. That's the last line of the Gemara. Mar Breda Ravina, Gehava Messiah, Slusa Merhachi, what did he say after his davening? Elokai Netzor, Lashoni Me Raz, Vasaimi Daber Mirma, Mikali Nafshi Tidom. I hope that's familiar to everybody here. That's the way we end every Shimon Esrei. But think about it for a moment. That's the Gemara. But the power of what I want to point out to you is not the Gemara. It's thinking about what's missing. The Gemara just described what a particular one of the Chachamim said after his Shimon Esrei. So that is a perfect example, a pure example of a personal, I don't know if we call it spontaneous, but certainly a personalized, subjective tefillah. And what did we do as a Jewish people? We took this particularly beautiful, resonant, profound, insightful, individualized, personalized tefillah of a particular Chacham, and what do? We fixed it, we formalized it, we institutionalized it, we made it part of the Siddur for every one of us every time we say Shimon Esrei. Isn't that striking? In other words, you see, again, I'm not saying anyone did this consciously, but taking the bird's eye view, we look back historically, we see what happened. Even things which started out spontaneous, they can't stay that way. In order, they became formalized because, you see, not individually and even as a nation, We need to institutionalize things. We need to formalize things. And therefore, this very tefillah, the Note of Yehuda, the famous Note of Yehuda of Prague, he points out in this Gemara, why did the Chachamim do this? Why did they add these things? So that's what was the point I was mentioning before. These were added as ways of personalizing the tefillah. The Chachamim had fixed it, so they were going to personalize it. And what did we do? We took their personalized tefillahs and we fixed those. Isn't that fascinating? It's striking. But it just goes to underscore the point which I'm making, which is that we need it. We do need it. And I'll give you a personal story, which really, for me, dramatically highlighted this. The summer after my first year in YU, I went on a Kirov program in Russia called YUSSR, where we ran summer camps for kids in Russia who didn't know anything. And we gave them, hopefully, a good time. We gave them three nice meals, which a lot of them were not used to. And we gave them a dose of Judaism for a few weeks. So every day we would have davening, we had Hebrew-Russian siddurim that we made, and I would daven with them, and we tried to add another bracha each day. And I remember as I was getting close to the bracha of the Shema Kolenu, which if we have time for them this year, we'll get back to this, we have a tradition that that's one of the brachos where a person could really add personal bakashos, personal tefillos in that davening. And I was so excited for them. You know, in a few days we're going to get to this, you can say whatever you want. Tomorrow we're going to get... Today we finally got to the Shema Kolenu and I gave them, I prepped them, and now we're about to pause, and you can ask for anything that you want, for your parents, for you, whether it's money, religious, clothing, whatever you need, you can ask for it. And I thought I was going to make it so dramatic. So we're going to pause, and we're all going to close our eyes. That way no one should feel insecure, that anyone's looking at them. We're going to close our eyes, and then we're going to give it time, and everyone could say whatever they want. Oh, I was excited, and I got everyone into it. That was a great idea, Rabbi. It's amazing. So we get to the big moment, and everyone takes their hand over, like they're saying a Shema, if you will. Everyone covers their eyes. So what did I do? After about a second, I went like this. I peeked. I want to see what's going on. And to my utter shock, nothing was going on. People don't know what to say. They're lost. Now, you could say these were kids and 2 weeks earlier they never heard of the Shimon Esrei. Okay, that's a fair point. But in various forms, less dramatic, but in various forms, I've seen the same phenomenon many times since. As much as we sometimes, again, not everybody and not every point of their life, but many people, at least at some point in their lives, feel a certain frustration with the sitter. But the reality is there is no substitute. Because for most of us, again, certain super-duper spiritually sensitive and motivated people maybe, in theory, could get along without it. But for the overwhelming majority of people, exactly whatever the differences between our circumstances are and the time of after the first Churban of the Rambam's description, the reality and the problem is just the same. If we didn't have a sitter, we wouldn't daven because we couldn't daven. So that's not the only answer, and we're just starting this part, but... At first, just to get it out of the way, I think as the most minimalist thing, even if we don't talk about the beauty of the sitter, there's simply the necessity of the sitter. I think that's number one. Number two, for the mystically inclined, is again, I happen to not be so mystically inclined, but for those who are, it's just certainly representative of a certain stream in our tradition for sure. We should mention there's a second benefit, and that is in Reb Chaim Volozhiner, the famous Reb Chaim Volozhiner in his well-known book, The Nefesh HaChaim, is source number 6. He points out a tradition which has been picked up on by many traditions, certainly Hasidic and others, since he wrote it, where he points out a tradition, and I'm not sure exactly its origin, but he certainly popularized it for sure, says the Nefesh HaChaim, that you only understand, even if you understand, so the question that was mentioned before about understanding what you're saying, even if you understand every word in the Shemona Esrei, you're only understanding one very superficial dimension of the words. Because the Chachamim, when they wrote the Shemona Esrei, they embedded, maybe even encoded, into the words all sorts of super-duper high-level mystical secrets and Kabbalistic intentions. And you may not realize it, but your words, beyond what you can understand, are having an impact in various olamos and with the angels and all sorts of things. This is not irrational, this is a mystical idea. He points out just one little, very simple proof, quote-unquote, that he has. he makes the point here in source number 6. I'll just read the first few words where I have it underlined. Hamaskil, and if you think about it, Yavin Midata would understand on their own. Shelo lachinam hutrachu letikun tchina ketanu tfila ketzara kazu kuf chav zakenu mehem kamenavim. Think about it. You look at the Shemoneh Esrei. It's not remotely such a complicated tefillah. It's not long. And it's not even that complicated. I mean, just compare it to the Piyutim of Yom HaNaraim or the Kinos of Tisha B'Av. Those are far more complex liturgical and poetic creations. The Shemoneh Esrei brachos are relatively simple. They're straightforward. Every now and then there's kind of a high note and a little bit of a poetic allusion. But they're really straightforward and it's not even that big. Says Nefesh HaChaim, did you really need 120 of the most brilliant people to write that? You needed Nevi'im. The Rambam stresses there were prophets. It was prophetically inspired. You needed prophets to come up with Rafa'inu, to Atachonein. You know, I mean, you have to be a somebody, but so much. So Seth Nefesh HaChaim, no, you don't understand. That's just like the surface level of it. But these words were chosen and so carefully picked because they're actually all sorts of riddles and Kabbalistic secrets that are embedded in them. And we are unlocking and opening up worlds and all sorts of things which we can't even begin to realize. So our tefillos are far more powerful than we're even aware of. Now again, this is already something that's not just not a negative. This is where now we're talking about a positive. However, I would keep this at the beginning of our list because, let's say, for most of us, or at least I'll speak for myself, I don't really get a sense of this happening. I'm not saying I'm denying that it's happening, but I can't say I really know it's happening while it's happening or understand any of it. So experientially, which is really what is one of my priorities for tonight's year, to try to help us experientially daven better, I don't know. Again, some people, again, if you're mystically inclined, maybe knowing this and believing in this could help a person. But I would say for most of us, at least for me, even if I would know or even subscribe to this notion, I don't know if that necessarily translates into helping me daven better. But it is something to be keep in mind. Okay, that's a second approach. So again, our first approach is the siddur, we just need it because we have no substitute. We don't know what to say if we don't have it. Number two is that maybe there's a mystical idea. But now let's try to discuss it, which I think is a little bit more prosaic, which is a little bit more down to earth for most of us on our level, which I think if we think about it are actually very important benefits to using the fixed text of the siddur. So if you take a look at sources number 7 and 8, I have another idea. And this is, I think, very, very important if we think about it. And that is that the davening is not just a fixed text. The fixed text also expresses our priorities. The fixed text has, in essence, instructed us not just on how to daven, but what to daven for. To take as, by way of analogy, in source number 7, you have a very interesting selection from the Kuzari. The Kuzari, written by the Rav Yehuda Halevi, one of the classics of medieval Jewish philosophy. The whole structure of the book, some say it was historically inspired, some say it was just a fiction, but either way, it's expressing philosophical truth, whether there was ever a place and a king called the Kuzars. But it was about this king who was looking for different religion answers in his religious quest, and he's got representatives of different religions, including the Chacham, the hero of the book. And one of the things he discusses in source number 7 is not about the fixed text of the siddur, but like the evil twin, so to speak. For people who are unhappy with the siddur, what else are they unhappy with often? Tefillah b'tzibur. Why do we have to daven and shul and have to be the minion of everybody else? Wouldn't it be so much more meaningful if I could go off into a mountain, into the forest, and just look at a sunset and be by a lake by myself? I could meditate. I mean, the whole Eastern religion, there are all sorts of concepts. It's bodedus and all sorts of things. Why do I have to daven in a shul? Why can't I just be by myself? So it's not the same thing as the fixed text, but there's a certain overlap. And the Chacham tells him in source number 7, where I have it underlined, he says, you know, you have to understand, yitaron l'kahal and bikama panim, there are benefits to being in a community, not being by yourself. One of them is, ha-kahal eina mitpalim b'mash yesh bo hefseid li-yachid. Ba-yachid afshar shi-yitpal b'mash yesh bo hefseid li-yachid im-acherim. In other words, says the Kuzari, when we get together in shul, we daven for the right things. So you get into a fight with someone, it really messes you up, a contractor rips you off, or whatever it is, you're in a mood, you could start davening negative things. Think about it for a minute. Right? We daven for positive things. The one exception to that Ivla Mashinim, and the Gemara discusses how long it took and how hard it was to get that exactly right. And that's a very specific, historically inspired bracha. But for the most part, we have, it's not just what we're davening, but how we're saying it has been ordained. Think about it for a minute. This to me, again, if you think about it, how important, how revealing is it in terms of a whole Jewish way of life that when we have a whole section of gimme, gimme, gimmes, what we call bakasha, we have God, ask God for everything. Not just what we ask for, but think about something as subtle as the order. What's the first thing we ask for? Atachonein l'adam das. Could there be a more eloquent statement about the Jewish priority of wisdom, of learning, of study? It's the first thing we ask for. That's not just a bakasha, that's a hashkafa. That's expressing who we are, our identity, our priorities. Right? You could look for, there's nowhere in the davening that says, give me a Lexus. I'm not saying it's bad to have a Lexus, but we don't ask for small things. We ask for big things. The Chazal set a priority, a hierarchy of things that are important for us. Moreover, something that the Kuzari was alluding to, which the Gemara in Brachos in source number 8, the Gemara in Brachos on Lav Lamed points out, is not just what we ask for. What language is the fixed text? It's never what? It's never in the singular. Everything's in the plural. Right? We ask Hashem to give us wisdom, us good health, B'soch Shar Cholei Yisrael, us redemption, us forgiveness, us Yerushalayim, us. Why? Because as the Gemara says, it's so important, we daven b'loshon rabim. Why? Because a person should be lishatef inish, nafshei, pari tzibura. A person should feel connected. So even the language, even though we're thinking of ourselves, our loved ones, etc., but it's always in the plural. In other words, the Chazal, by fixing a text, haven't just helped us, because we wouldn't be able to daven on our own, they haven't just perhaps embedded mystical mysteries into the text, but they've given us a hierarchy of priorities, what's important, what's not important, what's appropriate to daven for, what's not appropriate to daven for. And this also is something very, very important. There's my friend, as I mentioned, Rabbi Yitzi Blau, who spoke about a similar topic, so he pointed out, Havdil, but in the Christian context, one of the greatest Christian writers of the 20th century, C.S. Lewis, I've read a number of his books, fantastic books, he was an apologist in the best sense of the word. He was writing in the 20th century to defend Christianity from the modern critique and secularism that was creeping in England at the time. And one of the things he points out about their religious prayers and stuff is that it comes to teach us what he called sound doctrine. So whatever that means in a Christian sense, but I think there's a kosher version of it too. There's a Jewish version of that too. And that is, again, what we're saying is that the davening is not just what we say, but if we're cognizant, again, if we're oblivious, if we're half asleep, if we're distracted, if we're looking at our phones, so we don't get any of this, unfortunately. Ironically, we might just get the Kabbalistic thing, maybe. I don't know how the Kabbalah works, but maybe just saying those words gives us that benefit. I don't know. But this is a benefit which we need to be conscious of. Again, if you're distracted, if you're bored, and if you're not even thinking about it, if you don't give it a chance, if you don't study it, then this won't help you. But if you really think about what you're saying, so then it's the best kind of education, because it'd be subtle and subliminal. But over time, it seeps into your bones, into your blood, what's important, what to ask for, that we care about other people, we have certain priorities, national, individual. That's another thing, which again, no matter who you were, if Hashem, if we just went back with the pre-sitter, we just went back to the Rambam's original idea, well, everyone could just daven with whatever they want. What are the odds that our davening would really be that rich? And conversely, how likely is it that we might, all of us, myself certainly included, might trip up on what some of these real appropriate priorities and requests really are? So I think that's a third point, which I think is very, very important. Again, we have to be sensitive to it, but I think that's a benefit that we get from Chazal doing a lot of the hard work for us. We have to do the hard work of having intent, of meaning it, but I think we still need, we still get that benefit. Any questions on that? Okay. If we have time for two more, we have.
Where are we including our personal bachashot and shemakos?
If I have time, Blinetter, I have three more points to mention. I want to mention two more about the sitter, and then the last point I want to mention is yours, okay? So give me a little bit more time. Yes, Mir Tashem. Okay. Another point, fourth point, which I think is, again, absolutely crucial. take a look at, if you turn over to the second page, source number 9, it's in English, so for those of you who English is your first language, you can certainly read it on your own. This is a very famous write-up of an essay, of a drusha, really, that was given by Rav Soloveitchik. There's a book, 2 volumes, called Reflections of the Rav. They were not written by Rav Soloveitchik, they were written by a student, Rabbi Bezdin, Olav HaShalom. And he had taped notes, and he wrote up in pretty easy to understand language, very famous drushas that Rav Soloveitchik had given orally. So one of the most famous of the Rav's drushas ever, and certainly one of the most famous in this book, is a well-known drusha that Rav Soloveitchik gave about Korach. I can't do justice to it, certainly in a few minutes that we have, but a very, very important drusha. But one of the points Rav Soloveitchik makes in this particular drusha is how mitzvos in general have 2 components. There's the form of the mitzvah. Let's say we shake the lulav, we eat the matzah. There's the outer form of the mitzvah. But then there's what he calls the inner experience, what the mitzvah is supposed to do to me, what I'm supposed to feel when I perform the mitzvah, which is what he says is the kiyum ha-mitzvah in many cases. Sometimes it's one and the same, but often he shows with a number of examples, davening being among the most prominent, where it's really 2 separate things. There's a physical, formal, external thing we do. We say the words, we sit here, we bend there, we eat matzah, we shake the lulav, we blow the shofar. But then there's the experience that we're supposed to have when we do these things, which is something internal. And that, he says, is the kiyum. That's the real fulfillment. Well, if the real fulfillment is internal in my heart, so he asks the question in the middle, about halfway down where the 3 dots are. If that's the case, then why not have the halacha just require us to have the emotional experience? Why tell me to daven? Just tell me what I'm supposed to feel when I'm davening, and I'll do that. Why tell me to blow the shofar? Why tell me to have simchas yomtiv? Why tell me to sit on a low chair if, God forbid, I become a mourner? Just tell me what emotional state, what feeling I'm supposed to have, and I'll do that. Why do I need the outer state? Why do I need the outer form? Just let me do that. If you're saying that the emotional is the point, so why not just obligate that? And here Rav Soloveitchik gives a very interesting and important answer. He says, if that would be the case, then religious emotion is volatile, ever-changing and unstable, even within an individual. To correlate the outward act to the inner emotion would require regular adjustments. The mitzvah would continually have to be modified and at times nullified. The format and identity of the mitzvah would be destroyed, and no continuity of identifiable performance would be possible. So first of all, Rav Soloveitchik, we have chaos. Because even one person, every time they did a mitzvah, it would have a different form, because it would be subjective, because if you say it's all about their feelings might change. But more than that, I think he's hinting at something which is even more important. And that is that what is one of the most beautiful and essential parts of any religion, but certainly of Judaism, is the idea of Mesorah. It's the idea that when you went into the sukkah this Yontif, you knew that more or less, this is the exact same thing that your grandparents did, and your great-grandparents did, and your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents did. Maybe they were in Israel, maybe they were in Morocco, maybe they were in North Africa, maybe they were in Russia, maybe they were in Poland, some of them were even in America. Wherever they were, whatever exactly the sukkah looked like, they were in a sukkah. They shook a lulav, and the same thing is true for davening. Part of the beauty is the fact that it is this continuity, is this Mesorah. If davening was left to our own devices, if every person could just make up their own davening, then there'd be no continuity. What would a father teach his son? What would a mother teach their daughter? And what would the grandmother and the granddaughter have in common? The answer is nothing. Slightly overstated, but barely. In other words, the idea that they can share, that they have a common language, that they can look at the sitter and say the same words and know that their bubby did it and their granddaughter will do it. Again, maybe because I'm reaching, getting a little older, but to me there's very few things as beautiful as that. And as moving as that, that's what connects us to our grandparents, that's what connects us to our grandchildren. This is the beauty of everything. If we didn't have a sitter, then we wouldn't have that, at least not in davening. If there would be no fixed form, whether it's matzah, lulav, shofar, or sitter, you wouldn't have that. Moreover, as he says on the last line of the paragraph, one of the key parts of Judaism in general, as we know, is the tzibur. We're not just a religion, we're also a nation, we're also a people. We believe in doing things together, having a nation. Well, how could we ever daven together in a meaningful sense if everyone in the shul was saying anything they wanted? the whole idea of tefillah b'tzibur would be completely nullified if everyone could say their own thing. The only way we could have a hope of having a tzibur, again, imagine any one of us that have been, you know, again, it's on our mind because it was recent, a beautiful Yomim Narayim davening. What makes a beautiful, again, when I was in Baltimore, I was in a beautiful shul for many years, beautiful singing, and now in the neighborhood that I live in, I daven in a yeshiva that has a beautiful davening. Two things go into what makes both of those incredibly special. They're different. One was for Balabatim in America, and one is for 18-year-old yeshiva kids in Israel. But two things are similar. Number one is the large crowd of people coming together, which you couldn't have if everyone said the same thing, said their own thing. But number two, in both cases, so much of the tunes of the customs are the same every single year. That's part of the point. That's not the problem. That's what makes it beautiful. People come back year after year and they know it. It's part of them. And it's so, so beautiful. In a similar, although I think a slightly different idea, we'll skip number 10 for a minute, we don't have time, but Salvation in a different essay makes the point in number 11, where he says here, again, it's in one line, but he's saying so much in one line. He says, Judaism is first a discipline and second a romance. You hear that? Judaism is first a discipline and then a romance. If you ask anybody, certainly in a human relationship, what's the exciting part? So they'll tell you, it's the romance. Right, for many couples, is those beginning of the dating or early years of marriage. Right, that's part of the challenge in any marriage, is trying to kind of keep that up, you know, as you know the habit and the rote creep in. So you want to try to keep up the freshness and the live and the romance, right? So says our salvation, something so powerful. It's same with Hashem also. It's same with religion also. It is true that the romance is amazing when we think about that in the sense of our relationship with Hashem, the passion, the excitement. But our salvation says you have to make sure you understand one thing. You only get to the passion, at least with Hashem, you only get to the romance through the discipline. Without that, you don't have it. Because then you have to spend so much time kind of thinking about what you're doing each time that you can actually lose sight of who you're doing it for. It's only because we have the discipline and the repetition and the practiced nature of things that then that becomes second nature to us, and then we can infuse it with the meaning and the passion. I think I mentioned to somebody before, and this is what I was trying to say, and that is that there's a difference. Again, I don't know how you would say this in Hebrew or even in Yiddish or anything else, but in English, I think it comes out very clearly. There's a difference between rote and practiced. Rote is bad. Practiced is amazing. And it's not just in davening. Think about it. If you like music, singing, any instrument you like to play, if you're an athlete, the drama, right? You know, film, anything, right? How could it be that two different people could play Beethoven's whatever symphony, different symphonies, you know, this Philharmonic and that Philharmonic, but, you know, people say, oh, that was a very different experience, you know, they played it that way, and they, or, you know, Macbeth, you go to this show, they could do it that, it's the same words, isn't it? The answer is because it's the same words, they are giving their own personal interpretation to it. It's not a contradiction. It's through the discipline comes that feeling. In sports, again, was something which I can relate to in any of the sports, American football, European football, a baseball, a basketball, right? You pick two of the greatest players, whatever it is, they don't play the exact same way. Isn't it the same rules, same ball, same stick? But with all the practicing they do, because then it becomes second nature, they don't have to think about it. Dance, right? It's the same thing. Once you get all those moves down, so then you're free because that's second nature, it's in your bones. Then you can add your personal interpretation to it. If you're too busy worrying about how to do it, you haven't really practiced it yet, right? Why do you think the greatest people, the greatest performances, which come off as so moving and spontaneous, were practiced for 1,000 hours beforehand? It's not a contradiction. However, if you ever went to a performance, again, it could be an actor, a comedy, music, whatever it is, and the performer looked like they were just going through the motions, it was rote, well, that's a disaster. When we look at those two different performances, you see the difference between someone who's going through the motions, giving me a rote performance, and someone who's giving me a practiced performance. We don't want someone to just wing it. We want them to have practice, don't we? It's through that they hone their craft. So through davening, through the discipline set of Salvechik, that's how it becomes romance. It's because making it second nature to us, and then we can concentrate on what's waiting on the other side. We start a little bit late, so we still have a few more minutes till we finish our hour. So I just want to conclude with my last point, which is what the gentleman asked before, which is that as much as we've now stressed for the last some minutes, the body of the shir, that through the siddur, through the fixed text, there are certain benefits which we don't always appreciate, but I think if we think about them, we see very clearly there are a number of benefits to having this fixed text. In terms of our, again, our inability, to be, if we're honest with ourselves, to daven on our own, the Kabbalistic mysteries, the mystical secrets that are there, the fact that we are connected to a larger tzibur, the fact that we're connected to history, the fact that we are we have a hierarchy of values, Chazal telling us what's important, what we should daven for, what we shouldn't daven for, the idea of the discipline of the second nature, all of that is important. But the last point, which is also important, is that we shouldn't forget what I said from the Rambam, which is that the al-kharkhila, the ideal was still to daven on our own. So even though we have all these reasons why we now have a sitter, we should be aware that we are allowed and encouraged to personalize our tefillos. And if you just, again, I'm not going to have time to look at it inside now, we just have a few minutes left, but the last four or five sources that I gathered to you are ones that make it abundantly clear that we are not only allowed, we're supposed to personalize our tefillos. The Gemara says in source number 12, anyone who makes their tefillah a keva is not a good thing. It says the Gemara, what is keva? Kol she'enu yachol l'chadesh badavar. If you're not adding something new, then there's something wrong. In other words, if you daven the same tefillah the day you have a huge business meeting as the same thing you daven the day before or the day after, it's clearly something off. Right? If you or your loved one or relative are about to go into some surgery, and that's just the same davening you daven every other day, then clearly there's something off. Because if it's real, if we're being real with Hashem, then of course, on some level, there's going to be variety. And that, the Gemara says, is totally, totally fine. And I'll end with just one last kind of insight, which I found to be fascinating. The Gemara in Kiddushan, on number 14. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Yitzro shel Adam mischadesh alav kol hayom. The person's Yetzer Hara is new every single day. So what does that mean? So some interpret that to mean, which I think is for sure true, that different people and at different stages of a single person's life, they have a different Yetzer Hara. Right? This is well known and for sure true. Maybe this is what they might mean. When a person is a 15-year-old, he has one Yetzer Hara. When they're 35, they could have a different Yetzer Hara. When they're 65, they could have a third Yetzer Hara. Just as an aside, I once heard from one of my mentors, Dr. David Pelkowitz. He said that as a person gets older, he said there's been studies about this biologically, as people age, a lot of the temptations or urges that they had at some point in their life are usually getting less and less as they are physically getting weaker, except for one. What's the one Yetzer Hara which gets worse as you get older? The Yetzer Hara for kavod. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Don't vocalize what you're now thinking about, whoever it is that you're thinking of that proves that point to you. Dr. David Pelkowitz was... Yeah, now it wasn't his own insight. He was quoting a study, I guess. But the second he says it, everyone's like, oh, yeah. Okay? So that could be the Maral, for example, really interprets the Gemara that way. That every day, or not literally every day, every different periods of your life, you have a different Yetzirah, and you have to do battle against that. Others say that Yetzirah is like, even if you think you have him down for the count, you knock him down, tomorrow he's going to be right back up. You can never defeat the Yetzirah, it's a lifelong battle. Okay? That's a second interpretation. But I want to share with you the third interpretation. Source number 15 is the Sheim Mishmuel. The Sheim Mishmuel was the second Sukkotchover Rebbe. First, his father was known as the Eglay Tal of the Avnei Nezer, a contemporary of the Chedusha Harim, a student of the Kutzker, one of the early generation of Hasidic leaders, and his son and his successor, the Sheim Mishmuel. So here, Shmuel Bernstein, or the Sukkotchover Rebbe, he has a different interpretation of the Gemara. Powerful. Source number 15. He says, you should know, I'm giving you a spiritual axiom, a metaphysical truth, that the koach, the power of chiddush, of newness, is put into the world every day. Bahamaskilim, those who are smart, notlin etzeh koach lavodas Hashem, they use that for spiritual benefit. And here, he is, interestingly, of all things, he says, ulechidush davar betfilah. Ube'imlav chas v'shalom, notlin asitra achret koach hazeh. What does it mean, at least on my level, what I think he means? human nature. We said it before from Rashi. Again, he's speaking a little bit more spiritually, metaphysically. There's a certain koach, or I would say attraction, I should say, to newness, to something being new and fresh. So he says there's a koach, a certain power, a force in the universe that attracts of newness, of freshness, of things being new. Says the Shem Yishmuel, that's a reality. People who want to just keep everything the same and never have anything changed, nothing ever new, you're fighting against forces that cannot be beaten. It's a reality of the world. There's a koach of chiddush every day. So what's the alternative then? We have no choice, he says, but to harness it for good. If we don't incorporate it and figure out a way to assimilate it and use it for good, then it'll be like, you know, bubble up somewhere else, as he says, for bad, or the sitrach, or some dark forces, so to speak, will use it. And again, you don't have to be a Kabbalist to just look around and see this, right? Whether it's in every generation, there's the young generation, people who want something new and exciting, and you know, in some generations, you have a Karlbach or somebody who can answer that. And when you have a spiritual, religious answer, so then those energies of instincts and attraction get brought in and beautifies the whole system. But when there's no answer for it in the system, the people will look for it somewhere else. Again, maybe they get older and then they don't care anymore. But certainly with young people, and he's not limiting it to young people, that's my editorial, but certainly more true with young people, they're looking always for something new. So our trick, which is incredibly hard, is figuring out a way to keep them within the continuity of the system, and yet with that newness. But that's what Shem Yishmuel says, we have no choice. And his example is interesting, is l'chadish bo'davar b'tfila. In other words, he's saying it's not just that for your benefit it's good to add things that'll make it more personalized, but he's saying there's a kind of a larger religious benefit to it. If we encourage people to personalize their tefillos. And it's true, you mentioned before, it's not the Shema Koleinu, it's not even just at the end of the Shemon Esrei, El Kain Etzor, we can add, those are all true, but the Shulchan Aruch says clearly, if one wants, and you have to learn a little bit how to do it, but in every one of the middle brachos, in every one of the bakashos, you can add things. And if you don't want to add things in your own words, you can do it in English, and even if you don't want to do that, at minimum, when you're saying the standard words, you can be thinking about personal things, for sure. For sure, that's at minimum, but you could do more than that. You finish your fe'enu, you could daven right then. You don't have to wait to Shema Kaleinu, you don't have to wait to Elokein Atzor. And if you want, you certainly can wait till the end. But if you add those things, if you make things new and personalized, so then, first of all, your davening will be better. But again, I think what he's saying, which I think is so important, is it's not just that your davening will be better. That'll have a spillover effect. Everything, in terms of Yavod Avodas Hashem, will be better. So I think if we think about some of these things, again, I don't know that we've never really solved all the challenges that some people have, but I hope we've opened a little bit some eyes and maybe even a few hearts to try to appreciate. Again, doesn't mean that we won't still struggle, certainly from day to day, if not every day, then sometimes, with having the most kavanah. Davening is hard. We didn't even address some of the other issues, but at least this particular issue of how do we balance the challenges of a fixed text. I think the first thing is to admit it. We shouldn't be in denial, oh, no, everything's... No, the fixed text of the Siddur does present certain inherent problems. But part of success in overcoming those is it being aware and acknowledging that, in fact, despite the challenges, there are some very real and obvious benefits from that. And if we can be sensitive to, if not focus on those, that will help us. And then, the balance is, but don't forget, we can still personalize it. And like so many other things in life, the key really is, not to be cliche, but the key is the balance. Either extreme, without any personalization, just the same sitter every time, that's clearly not what Chazal meant. And at the same time, it's clearly both not desirable and probably impractical to have only personal. The answer is to try to find this balance. So it doesn't mean that it's not a lifetime of work, but I think at least if we understand what we're trying to do, that can give us a nice direction on how to do it. Okay, that's what I have to say.